going. I apologize for the delay. I had another meeting that finished much later than I had expected. We've only got two bills on the agenda tonight, but we want to spend a few minutes with them. The first bill is Senate File 723, Senator Pappas, and we do have a quorum present. We just remind people that we try to keep demonstrations, I was going to say down to a minimum, but we don't have demonstrations, but want to make sure we give everybody an opportunity to have this bill, important bill, heard. And Senator Pappas, before we start, I think you have some people you'll want to testify. Normally we don't take testimony in the full committee, but I know we have a lot of people here interested in these bills, and we can certainly take testimony from some limited number of folks,
Mr.
if you
Chairman,
would like
we
that.
We just have three people
okay.
who, on our that we'd like to testify briefly.
Okay. Great. First of all, Senator Bonoff moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Pappas, Senate File 723.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I think people are probably pretty familiar with what's been called over the last decade or so the DREAM Act. This is the Minnesota version of the DREAM Act, also called the Prosperity Act, which would allow undocumented students who live in Minnesota, are Minnesota students, for all intents and purposes, grew up in Minnesota, to be able to attend college at the non-resident, at the resident rate, and be eligible for financial aid. They have to have attended high school in the state for three or more years. They have to have graduated from Minnesota high school or obtained their GED, and they have to The division added legislation that said they have to document they've complied with selective service registration requirements, and then clarified the original language that said if a federal process exists for the student to obtain lawful immigration status, the student has to present documentation to the higher ed institution that they have done that. They've made application for legal status. What's of most interest to the committee is, I think, the fiscal note, and there are people here who can testify to the fact that the university in Minsk will absorb any additional cost. And, of course, we don't really charge on a per-student basis anyway for our colleges and universities. And the additional cost to the state grant system would be absorbed really with the additional investment in the grant system of $80 million. But if we were looking at it as at a per-pupil cost, it would be something like $1 or $2 per student. And the Office of Education has estimated they would need about $100,000 to create an alternative FAFSA, since these students are not eligible yet to use the federal FAFSA. They would not be eligible for the Pell Grant. That would have to be changes on the national level. And Senator Bonoff is carrying that amount in her omnibus bill. This is all about education. It's all these are students who live in Minnesota, and they're
I'm
going
sorry,
to be in
excuse
Minnesota.
Me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. I was going to let Senator Pappas finish, then we'll make that correction.
And we really are responsible as a society to make sure they're educated so that they can become productive taxpaying citizens and contribute to the great state of Minnesota, which they want to be. They feel like they're Minnesotans. Their dream has been to go to college, and they often found out a rude awakening in their senior year in high school that that dream was going to be snatched away from them because of the not undocumented status of their parents and themselves. They play by the rules, they got good grades, and we're prepared to do that. And so it's been very sad. We have, there has been some private money that was raised. I believe there are six Dreamers that are in college at the University of Minnesota on a Regent scholarship. I have no idea if any were able to get scholarships to go to any of the Minsk institutions. Some of our institutions are at flat rate now, some of our 2 years in particular, but still the $8,000 a year is not affordable for these students because their parents don't have that kind of money to help them, and they're not able even to legally work. So I have just I'll take questions, and then maybe while Senator Bonoff is making her comments, maybe our two students that are here to testify, Thalia and Nestor, could come and join me.
Okay. Senator Pappas, a couple things. Now, the fiscal note we have shows a cost of $539,000, but you've indicated that the proper cost is the, what, $100,000 cost?
Mr. Chairman, that includes a, if we were to look at what we estimate might cost the state grant. But it's
the
it's
539.
Within, yes, it's within, though, the appropriation for the state grant. It's not additional.
Okay, so the additional appropriation is the roughly $100,000
right.
for the, is that the one-half FTE and then administrative costs within the agency?
Yes, that's correct, and Ms. Grimes is here to testify on that if there are any questions.
And what Senator Bonoff wanted to indicate is that it's not being carried in her bill, but what we're going to, if the bill passes, we would appropriate the money as part of the standalone bill and have money available for that. The other question I wanted to ask before we have the testimony is, how many other states in the country, if you know, have already allowed for these opportunities?
I'm looking it up because I think, Mariano, it's 23 states? 21? We have it already.
Mr. Bonner has just answered my question that it's apparently...
Mr. Chairman, 13 states have this legislation to authorize. And in addition, 21 states in addition have introduced legislation to provide this access. And Oregon's governor recently signed the Portland Dream Act on April 2nd, and Colorado Senate and House passed the Colorado Dream Act, and the bill is now on the governor's desk. So we are at 13 states, did you say? And now maybe two more are coming on board.
All right. And you wanted to have your witnesses testify?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, do we want to ask questions about the finance or about the fiscal note first, or do we want to...
Up to you, Senator Fischbach, if you'd like to. Or
actually, Mr. Chair, it is up to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, since the witnesses are here, after they're done, we could bring up the Office of Higher Education to help with those questions.
That's a good idea. Great to have both of you here. Just identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Nestor's ready. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nestor Gomez. I'm 19 years of age, and I've lived in the United States since I was 9 years old. My parents brought me here to reach new goals and opportunities. I started school in Minnesota when I was in fourth grade. Everything went smooth until I reached high school and my life changed. I knew I was undocumented, and I've always known that I was at a disadvantage in the higher education system and society. Metaphorically, this status has pulled me back and has restrained me mentally from fully excelling in my studies, which I dearly care of. As high school progressed and reached my senior year, I felt that I had not accomplished anything. I had not put out any effort into my classes and thus needed to showcase and test my abilities. I decided to take advanced placement courses and also gained the confidence to enroll into a community college and achieve a higher education. I graduated from Robbinsdale Armstrong High School in 2010, and since then I've been in school working up to 3 jobs just to pay for my tuition. Now I'm a sophomore at North Hennepin Community College, and I plan to transfer soon. I don't receive any form of financial aid, and I'm not eligible to apply from any of my college's scholarships. As of this moment, I have reached a critical point in which if I'm struggling just to pay a couple $1,000s a semester, how am I going to start paying tuition somewhere else like the University of Minnesota? I love my family, my community, and friends because they have always helped me through difficult situations like these. Now it's time for you to help me and those who have studied here all of their life, have been admitted to wonderful institutions, and have all the capabilities to achieve a higher education like anyone else. To dreamers, Minnesota is our home. We admire and care for it. We want what's best for it, and I highly believe this bill is going to solve many problems in the public school system, the higher education system, and on top of that, will bring the state to prosperity. My dream is to become an environmental engineer. I am an environmentalist who is striving to create alternative energies and more sustainable bioproducts for society. Please support my dream and the dreams of thousands of students in Minnesota to access a higher education. Please pass Senate File 723. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That was very good testimony, but again, we don't have applause during the hearing. Mr. Gomez, let me ask you. I mean, it sounds like you in high school got pretty good grades, I would guess. Would that be fair? I'm going to ask you class by class, but would that be a fair statement? That
I would say that throughout high school, I suppose, it was mostly my senior year that I got motivated enough to really push myself and get good grades. Okay.
But in the process, you certainly can be accepted at a state college or university, but you have to pay the non-resident tuition, correct?
At North Hennepin Community College, there is a flat rate. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you're not eligible for the state grant program.
I am not.
So that's what the difficulty becomes, is it's simply quite expensive for you to go unless, as you suggest, you're working all the time.
Definitely, sir. I mean, it's hard enough for me to pay for my tuition, and at times I had to work up to 3 jobs.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Talia Estrada. I was born in 1995 in Lima, Peru. At the age of 4, my parents left my home country, and they came to the U.S. in search for a better life due to the fear of losing our lives. After spending my 5th birthday back in my home country, my parents had everything ready for me and my older brother to fly into the U.S., and little did I know that that was going to be the last time I would see my family. I came here in 2001, and I was enrolled in school 3 days after my arrival. I began kindergarten like any other child who was born here, and years passed, and slowly I started to forget my past. I no longer remembered my life in Peru. I grew up thinking the U.S. was my home. It wasn't until high school till I understood how our government worked. Now that I knew what a Social Security number meant, I began to run through many closed doors. I knew my life was going to be a lot harder, but I didn't want to prove those who were going to go far right. I am now a senior at Central Senior High School. I have done more than 40 hours of volunteer service at the United Hospital and community events. I have maintained a grade point average of 3.5, which means I have been an honor student since my freshman year. I have also completed a biology course at Hamline University. This all may sound so great, and even though I may have been accepted to the top universities of Minnesota, I face the fear of not being able to pay for my tuition. My brother goes to Minneapolis Technical College as a part-time student, and my parents still struggle to pay for his tuition every 6 months. I'm scared to think about how I'm going to support myself financially because I'm not eligible for financial aid. It's frustrating to think that all my hard work in school is worth nothing when it comes to scholarships. I'm only applicable to 1 scholarship out of 10 because of my situation. It's frustrating just because I'm undocumented, my GPA is worth nothing. It's frustrating to think that in my own country and my own state that I cherish so much and have contributed is making my future goals so difficult when I know I can do so much more. I am now speaking here for the many dreamers. We won't give up. We will keep fighting and searching for better doors, better open doors, to make our lives a little bit easier. I may have been born in Lima, Peru, speaking Spanish, but I have lived here almost my entire life, and I consider Minnesota my home. Please, I am asking you to support my dream. My dream is to become a neurosurgeon, and all I need is, you know, an opportunity to afford my tuition. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, not so much questions, but really just wanted to let you know that I so strongly support your dream. And Senator Pappas was the higher ed chair for so many years, and I know Senator Fischbach has been higher ed chair, but I've watched Senator Pappas have so much passion around this issue, and I've grabbed that baton because as we look at our workforce needs of tomorrow, I know that you are key to Minnesota's future success, that you are integral. And so I'm so proud of what you've brought to your studies and to your own journey, and am hopeful that we this year will find a way to open those doors that have felt closed. So thank you.
Okay, other questions from committee members?
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, I was looking over the requirement that is imposed that our documentation that the student has complied with selective service requirements would be needed as a prerequisite.
Okay, so
doesn't selective service, isn't that focused on American citizens? And are these students considered citizens or are they not?
Mr. Chairman, that was not my original bill. That was added in division.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, I can't say I'm very familiar with it. But I do believe that that legal residents also have to apply for, comply with, register with the Selective Service. And that we do, in fact, I think nationally, part of the path to citizenship could include being a member of the Armed Services.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not so sure about that. I'm not sure if the U.S. government could impose a draft on someone who was not an American citizen.
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't say you have to join up. It just says you have to register.
Well, that too, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, is a requirement on U.S. citizens of 18 years or older. And even if a student didn't do this, I don't know how it would stand. I don't know if there would be standing in court. I don't think it could be enforced because the student is not formally a citizen of the United States. So I'm not sure why we would have this as a prerequisite.
Mr. Chairman, it was a member of your caucus that added this amendment in division, and I don't remember who it was. Do you remember Senator Fischbach?
I do.
Or Senator Bana?
Mr. Chair, I think it was Senator Pratt.
And Senator Pratt is, Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt is actually here, and he's working right now as we speak on his iPad to get the information for Senator Limmer's question, so perhaps we could come back to it.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, you don't have to be a citizen to enlist. You can be on the path to citizenship. A number of folks who have been citizens have enlisted and served and fought on behalf of our country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then one of the requirements is that these young people be on the path to citizenship.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more testifier, Mr. Sean Kershaw from the Citizens League, who's really here to represent the civic and business community. I did pass out a handout with a long list of organizations, including the Minnesota Chamber, that support this legislation.
Okay. Mr. Kershaw, if you can identify yourself.
Yeah, good evening, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Kershaw, and I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens League. I'm here tonight, first of all, grateful for the opportunity to testify and ask you to support Senate File 723 for three reasons. Our economy depends on it. Number two, our autonomy as a state demands it. And number three, we must close the achievement gap. Like you, I have the opportunity to talk with Minnesotans about their hopes for the future and what makes this a great state. And what compels me about Minnesota's story is not what we were given in the geography and certainly not the weather or the natural resources, but what Minnesotans made of these. For generations, Minnesotans have taken challenges like our relatively remote location and our climate and turned them into opportunities. We've taken our natural resources from timber to taconite to topsoil and used them to transform the world. Made in Minnesota isn't a statement about where these goods and services were made. It's a statement about the creativity, the idealism, and the practicality of the Minnesotans who made them. This amazing mindset is our real export to the rest of the world, and we'll need it as we face the next generation of challenges. So how does this point relate to the bill before you today? In the coming years, we face significant economic challenges that will demand this made in Minnesota mindset. In just 12 years, the labor force growth will slow to almost zero, This is a decline in growth of almost 90% from 20 years ago. And this happens at exactly the same time when baby boomers turn 80 and their health care costs increase substantially at current rates. According to projections, Minnesota employment projections, job openings are projected to significantly exceed labor force growth in the next 10 years. Two-thirds of jobs in 2018 will require some form of higher ed. And data from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce shows that 43% of employers are already having issues recruiting qualified employees. And while the number of high school graduates is actually projected to decline, the number of students of color from high school and immigrant students in particular is increasing. Their historically low college-going rates must be reversed. These demographic trends will determine our destiny only if we fail to act. For example, we all talk a lot about closing the achievement gap, and we should, but this bill is a chance to act on something with proven results. In the states that have passed similar legislation, they have seen both graduation rates and college attendance rates increase among eligible students. We all talk about competitiveness in terms of taxes and spending, and we should, but not enough in terms of having the skilled workforce to achieve this competitiveness. This is why the Prosperity Act is so important to pass now. As the federal government debates immigration reform, one thing is clear. The federal government will not solve our state issue. Choosing who is eligible for state financial aid and in-state tuition is fundamentally a state's right. This bill is not an act of charity to a group of individuals. It's an investment in Minnesota's future economic health and well-being. And there is almost no cost to the choice you're being asked to make, but I believe there's a significant cost in doing nothing. And while the Prosperity Act is not just about the current students who will benefit from it, I can think of no group that better exemplifies the entrepreneurship and the democratic ideals of Made in Minnesota as the dreamers who have worked for years to make this legislation today possible. These students are the present-day embodiment of the risk-taking, the creativity, and the hard work that makes Made in Minnesota meaningful and possible. And finally, you'll all be receiving a letter of support from a number of people that I'm here to represent today. And during a time when we strive for solutions that cross traditional boundaries of interests and ideologies, I challenge you to find an issue that reflects the same breadth of support. We have Education Minnesota and the Chamber of Commerce signing on in the same piece of paper as this legislation. So please vote for Senate File 723 and make the Prosperity Act a reality. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kershaw. Questions for Mr. Kershaw?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fishbach.
I thought that there was no demonstration.
Yeah, I'm sorry. If we could.
And I know it's quiet. I mean, I understand that they're being quiet, but let's enforce the rules, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, that was my fault. I encouraged them to do that. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni.
People in this audience should not follow Senator Tomasoni. he sets a bad example for all of us.
Bad example.
So, yes, if we could please refrain from any demonstrations, silent or otherwise. And that includes you too, Senator Thomas. Okay.
Mr. Chair, especially Senator Tomasoni should refrain. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, if I had the gavel, things would be different.
Okay.
But I do have a question.
Questions
Mr.
for Mr.
Chair.
Kershaw.
I do have a question.
You have a question for Mr. Kershaw?
Yes.
Yeah, Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kershaw, you talk about job openings and forgive me for not knowing the federal law, but how would you employ, if they graduate in 4 years and there's no path to citizenship since they're working on it right now, how do you employ undocumented workers?
That would have to be a part of the larger federal changes. Our concern in Minnesota is making sure we've got the skilled workforce we need to fill the jobs that we have. So that would be a two-part strategy. The gap will still be there. And it's important that we do the best we can to close the gap in terms of skilled workers.
But, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kershaw, essentially under the current federal law, with or without a four-year degree, they could not be employed. Is that? I mean, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kershaw, there's no – and I'll let you answer. I'm sorry.
No, our concern, I believe you're right in terms of the current law. Our concern looking forward is Minnesota still faces a shortage. So the more we can do to prepare for the federal legislative changes, this is a step, in essence, in preparing for those changes. If those changes are made, we're going to need workers who have the skills that our economy in Minnesota will demand.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kershaw, but right now as it stands, that it is, and if the feds do something, and if it includes something, and there's a lot of question marks still there on what the federal government's going to do.
Agreed.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to quickly clear up something. I found the website for the civil service system, and they say that male immigrants living in the U.S. who are 18 through 25 must register with Selective Service. Undocumented immigrants, legal permanent residents, and refugees are all required to register for Selective Service. And there's only a few exceptions, and those are students that are on visitor visas and men who are part of a diplomatic or trade mission in their family. So all males 18 to 25 that aren't in those two categories have to register.
Senator Bonoff.
Well, Mr. Chair, I, too, was just going to read from the website. And I didn't see that particular part. I just saw the part that says, attention, undocumented males and immigrant servicing groups. You want to protect yourself for future U.S. citizenship and other government benefits and programs by registering with Selective Service. Do it today.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier, I guess to Senator Fischbach's point, having everybody educated but not able to get a job could be a not an outcome that is cheap for somebody paying, but so I would echo that concern. Statement you made was the cost. There's basically no cost or little cost to this. Are we allowing this and they pay the full cost of all our state colleges and universities? Or do they pay the same rate as other students, which the state subsidizes generally half or more of the base cost or the fixed cost of the universities, at least the state universities? Would that cost be different for students
Mr.
under the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom, the whole point of the legislation is to acknowledge that these students are Minnesota students, and they should be treated as Minnesota students and receive in-state tuition and have access to financial aid.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, how many would you estimate new students would be in the system?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the fiscal note says something like 600 to 750 students, so it's a few students per campus.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Kershaw? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
If the Office of Higher Education would like to join me at the table for any questions about their fiscal note.
Welcome. If you could just identify yourself.
Megan Fitzgibbon with the Office of Higher Education.
Okay. I believe Senator Pappas had inquired as to whether or not you could make sure we understand what the fiscal note does, what you need relative to the office.
The Office of Higher Education estimates or is assuming we will have a one-time cost of approximately $100,000 for the first year of the biennium in order to purchase or contract with or do IT technology investments to develop a statewide or state FAFSA form, federal, which would be based on the federal application for student aid. And then our fiscal note does include what we have estimated as an increased cost to the state grant or state financial aid programs. However, that can be absorbed within the state grant program because the state grant program has mechanism to carry over any over expenditures in the first year to the second year because we have a rationing, can ration between the first and second year of the biennium.
Okay, so relative to the fiscal note, what I'm looking at is in 14, the fiscal note indicates a cost of $639, in the second year $539. So you'd be able to handle the 539 for 14 and 15. What you can't handle is the 100.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's okay. Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, and I'm just wondering, you don't see any ongoing costs for the IT, just the one time? And I know there was discussion in higher ed about purchasing a program from California potentially, but would there be no ongoing changes or upkeep on that system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, our expectation is that we will either be able to develop in-house or maybe purchase or contract with, say, California or Texas for the software in order to do that. And then we assume there will be some cost. Some we have estimated in the fiscal note that we would have about 0.5 FTE, but the agency has determined that's something that we can absorb with it in our administrative costs.
Thank you.
Okay. Sir Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the Office of Higher Ed. Can you please explain how the current students that are getting financial aid under the state grant program would be affected if Senate File 723 were to pass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, we have estimated that it would potentially impact somewhere between $1 to $2 per student. Of course, that's always can be impacted by the number of credits a student is enrolled, but that would mean that potentially, and this is assuming that every student we've assumed in our fiscal note all goes to school in 1 year and they all go at a particular level, enrollment level, that potentially all the other state grant recipients could see their state grant reduced by about a dollar per year, so something on the order of 33 cents or 50 cents a semester. And that's assuming every single student we've assumed actually goes to school and gets state grant.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So it's not the intent of the Office of Higher Education to drop anybody off of the state grant program or replace them with students that would become eligible with the passage of Senate File 723. Just students would get $1 to $2 less in state grant funding. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I'd say it's fair. I mean, the expectation is that they would just become eligible students, and therefore they would be part of the same pool as any other student would, and that could potentially impact the other students, you know, but for the fact that those students weren't in the pool, they could see their grants reduce. But it all depends on how many of those students we assume actually show up.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, of course, if we do increase the state grant by $80 million, then we're talking about a reduction in their increase,
yeah,
not an actual reduction.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier, how did you come up with the estimate of 650 to 700, 600 to 750? And I mean, could that number be off by half or 75? I mean, how do you come up with that number? Doesn't seem like that big of a number to me if that's what we're just talking about here. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, we actually used a method similar to that was used in Maryland when they were considering the enactment of their DREAM Act. And we applied that same formula to Minnesota, knowing that we didn't have as large of a immigrant population than Maryland does, per se, or Texas or California. And it's also important to point out that even in Texas and California, where they've had in-state tuition for undocumented students and/or state grant, state financial aid for the last 10 years, their student population still has less than 1% of students that are qualifying for in-state tuition or financial aid through their DREAM Act. So even with that, they still have a very small population of students that are actually going to school or going to college on it.
But we did use that same method that Maryland did, and then and then just applied it to Minnesota's population, knowing that our immigrant population is different than that of Maryland or other states.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up. So, what percentage would this be of our student population comparable to? You said Texas is not even 1% yet. Without getting into the methodology and how they've come up with this, you're saying that those states have all used the same methodology, we're using the same, and they're not at 1%. Were they factoring that they might get to 1%? And how does that compare to our numbers? What percent is this number of ours?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, using that methodology, the estimate was 0.23% of all students enrolled in public post-secondary institutions at any point in time would benefit from this bill. And then we use that knowing that obviously there are, for financial aid purposes, for state financial aid purposes, there are students attending private institutions as well. And so there are approximately 200 additional students. So that's still, you know, less than a third of all the students in higher education in Minnesota could qualify, less than a third of a percent qualify could potentially be eligible for state financial aid. But for students attending public institutions, it would be 0.23% was our estimate.
Okay. Further questions? Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The numbers that I'm hearing really surprised me in terms of they're so small. We start talking about $1 to $2 per student is just insignificant. The cost or the administrative costs of say $100,000 is insignificant in terms of our overall budget. And so I'm really struggling to try and catch up with what I am. I didn't expect to hear these kinds of numbers. So let me try and ask in terms of financial aid to this group of students. And when you say 600 to 750 students, that also surprises me. I would have thought it was a much bigger number. Do you or would you be able to give us an estimate as to the total amount of dollars from the state grant program that would become available to the 600 to 750 students? I'm trying to ask the question a little bit differently because the $1 to $2 per student really it's not computing for me. So how much money would you anticipate the undocumented students would receive out of the state grant program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the impact that we've estimated is the $539,000 that's listed on the fiscal note. And that in the first year, it's $639,000. $100,000 of that would be the technology costs, but the ongoing cost would be the $539,000, and that would be the increase in state grant. And the one thing that is important to point out is that we've also assumed here that a large percentage of the students that would qualify under this bill are going to attend the public institutions, and namely, most likely, the state colleges and universities. So their state grant dollars per student are smaller, and we have also assumed that many of them will not necessarily attend full time. And so the way the state grant is modeled, the fewer credits you're taking, the smaller your grant is usually. So that's where that very small $1 to $2 impact on other students who are currently receiving state financial aid, the actual dollars per student are going to be very small.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Bevis.
Sir Newman, I think why the numbers are so small really goes back to the achievement gap. So even with documented Latino students, their graduation rates are lower and their college attendance rates are lower. So now you put on top of that an undocumented group, you know, and I think these were exceptional students that are up here, but for a lot of them, they maybe have found out their status early on in their high school career and then got discouraged and thought, well, what good does it do for me to study hard if I'm not going to be able to go to college anyway? So we think that, actually, I think the numbers will increase over the years as the word spreads, or if a legal status, a legal process becomes available for them, and then, and we tell them at a very young age, like we should be telling all our kids, that you're going to college.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Sarah Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This might be an opportunity to talk for a minute about the post-secondary options. I think they are open, I mean, totally available to all students that are in the secondary schools, whereby they can get college credits for the courses that, or certain courses that they take. And it does lower the cost of college, and it does help with the lowering of the amount of time you have to spend in a college. And I'm sure that it's a good encouragement for young students to work harder to take those courses. Because if you can cut a year off of college, that's like cutting, you know, a saving of, you know, many thousands of dollars. And I don't know how some students do it, but there's some students I've talked to that have cut a couple years off of college, which is, a great benefit to families and a great benefit to the student because they get to achieve their goal faster. So, I think this is a great idea and one that needs to be pursued, but also don't forget about the opportunities that are out there right now.
Mr. Chairman, there's a fabulous program at St. Paul College in cooperation with the St. Paul Public Schools where students can actually attend college for 2 years while they're students in St. Paul Public Schools and get some kind of a medical technical degree. So, yes, to all the parents in the room, your students should really take advantage of post-secondary options. And Thalia did mention that she had taken a class at Hamline through the post-secondary options program.
Ms. Fitzgibbon, I had a chance to look at the assumptions, and I would have no reason to think that they'd be any different, but obviously they're based upon using a percentage from states that are much larger. I mean, Hypothetically, if you know, there were counselors in the high school system who encouraged students to go on to post-secondary, it might be possible this might be a little bit larger. The assumption is, based on what I'm reading, just a little bit of guesswork. Would that be fair?
Mr. Chair, that would be fair. I mean, we would expect, and I think we even have that somewhere in the long-term fiscal implications, is that with the ability to access state financial aid and in-state tuition at those public institutions where they aren't getting it currently, you would assume there would be more students graduating from high school, more students getting their GEDs or high school equivalents, and going to college and accessing this aid, but we don't really know how to estimate that. It's a very difficult thing to estimate.
Okay. Further questions for Ms. Fitzgibbon? Okay, thank you, Senator Pappas. What we are missing from the bill, Mr. Nauman and I have been talking, is that we are looking for the one-time appropriation for the $100,000. We don't have an appropriation section, so. Mr. Bodden, did you have a suggestion for the language?
Mr. Chairman, what I would suggest is on page 3, after line 2, insert a new section with the headnote appropriation that provides $100,000 in fiscal year 2014 is appropriated to the Office of Higher Education for the information technology costs associated with the implementation of this act. This is a one-time appropriation. And then we'd renumber the following section. And there is also one small item that I think the division report left out that needs to be picked up on page 1, line 16. delete everything after the comma. You could include that if you wish.
Well, we're adding a new section. Let's take care of that first. Senator Pappas?
I'll move that.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves the appropriation section as recommended by counsel. Is there further? Senator Nino?
So, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming the appropriation just comes out of the general fund then, and this is getting tracked where?
This is tracked by Mr. Nauman against where we are with the general fund. And so it certainly balances. I mean, it's customary over the years that where we have individual bills, we will try to have some money on the bottom line for such purpose, and this obviously fits. Certainly,
and Mr. Chair, I think you answered my second question. Do we have money on the bottom line where we're not going to put things out of balance?
Yes, as I indicated. So, so we have Senator Pappas moving the language as suggested by counsel. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Mr. Bodner, do you want to suggest your technical change?
And Mr. Chairman, this is just a very small piece of language that I think the division report left on the remainder of line 16. If you look at page 1 of the bill on line 16, I think the language that follows the comma should also be deleted so that that new clause that's inserted in the division report works together with the existing language. So on page 1, line 16, delete everything after the comma would be my recommendation to make the division report work with the bill.
Okay. Senator Pappas, do you wish to move that language?
I'll move that.
All right. Is there further discussion on that motion, Senator Pappas, as suggested by counsel? Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bodern, when you're saying delete everything after the comma, do you mean just up until the completion on line 1.19 so that then you would continue to have subdivision B and C?
Mr. Bonham.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, yeah, the only words, I'm sorry to bore the committee with this, on page 1, line 16, the only language that would be affected by that amendment would be the words, the filing of N. Then the division report picks up the deletion of lines 17 to 19. Everything else remains in the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Senator Bonoff already asked my question.
Okay, fine. All right. On Senator Pappas's motion, is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Further discussion on Senate File 723. If there's no further discussion, Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 723 as amended be recommended to pass, sent to the floor.
All right. If there's no further discussion on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries and the bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Next, sir. Okay, next we have on the agenda Senate File 271, Senator Champion. And if people are leaving after this bill, if you could do so quietly, we do have the next bill in front of us. Thank you. Senator Champion, if I see you coming up there.
Make sure that you have one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. I would ask that you... turn to the handout that I have, Mr. Chair, which is for Senate File 271. And that's what I will use to go through my presentation. And it looks like they're trying to get up the screen and some other things that I would like to have. But just to sort of put this in context while they are doing that, some folks have asked me the question, why is this important? And if you look at page 1 of your handout, it is that I believe that it's important for all individuals to have a driver's license, especially if they're driving on Minnesota roads. And I think it's a public safety issue, and it affects all of us. I believe that a passage of Senate File 271 creates safer roads. It increases the number of insured drivers. As you know, that a person cannot get insurance if they don't have some sort of driver's license. I believe that it also will decrease the number of car accidents. I know that's a hard one to, prove. But I believe if people are driving legally and without the stare and the challenge of law enforcement, I think it would help decrease the number of accidents. I think it protects the civil rights of all residents. It creates family stability and healthier communities, and it promotes integration and collaboration between the immigrant community and local governments. If you look in the section where I'm talking about the economy, I just lifted some information from one of our immigrant groups just to sort of let you know how our ability and willingness to coexist really helps us all. In 2010, the Latino buying power in Minnesota totaled $5.1 billion. And Latino-owned businesses had sales and receipts of $1.6 billion and employed a little under 6,000 people in Minnesota. And if all unauthorized immigrants were removed from Minnesota, the state would lose roughly $4.4 billion in economic activity, $2 billion in gross state product, and approximately 24,000 jobs. We all win. Businesses will be better equipped to recruit and retain workers. Workers will have the ability to access and be mobile for jobs, and we can help to create financial stability in our communities of color. When we think about our future, before I get to exactly what this bill will do, as baby boomers retire, immigrants will increasingly be critical for continued economic growth and ensuring a steady flow of new workers. And the U.S. needs new taxpayers to help fund Social Security and Medicare and new workers to fill retiree positions and provide health care services. If you look at the next page, there's one big fact. Almost 80% of all people in Minnesota drive alone to work. And then if you go to the next page, Senate File 271 is a driver's license modification. Right now, in current law, if you want a driver's license, you have to do three things. One, you have to prove, you have to demonstrate proof of your identity. The second thing that you have to do is test. So you got to do your permit and your driving test. And if you're able to do that, then you get a Minnesota driver's license. And when you think in terms of the proof of identity, that's the portion that I would like for you to focus on, is because to apply for a Minnesota driver's license, you may present a Minnesota driver's license, instruction permit, or state identification card that is current. If you do not have one of these, you must present one primary and one secondary form of identification. The primary document must contain your legal name, first, middle, and last, and the month, date, and year of your birth. What Senate File 271 would do is add a primary document to the list of identification purposes, i.e. like a passport. And what I'm asking and what I would like to have happen is that if you look in the bill on page 3, lines 3.5, what it does for the purposes of this section, it says that for the purposes of proving one's identity, it means that there can be presented an unexpired passport issued by a country other than the United States with a certified birth certificate from a country other than the United States in the District of Columbia, Guam, and others. And the passport under this paragraph must have security features that make the document impervious to alteration as is reasonably practical in its design. So really is to say that I think in order to prove identity under this bill, one could use a passport or present a passport that can be authenticated, can be verified, has the security features from another country. The person still would have to, in order to get a driver's license, still have to pass the test, still has to do everything else that is required under the law. Now, what is also important to note here is that Minnesota had this process prior to 2003. This was a process that we did have in place at one time. And then after 2003, some things would change, and you will hear from the testimony of Pat McCormick from Drivers and Motor Vehicle Services exactly what that process looks like. And she will answer the question affirmatively that the department still has the ability to do exactly what we are requesting here in Senate File 271. And as I mentioned earlier, testing would still happen. But again, we think that it's important and that it will create safer roads and all the other notions that I put forward. And with that, I do have an amendment that I would like to put forward, which is the A5 amendment, Mr. Chair.
If we could have that amendment distributed.
A5 amendment, Mr. Chair, if you'd like for me to articulate what it is.
Yeah, if we could just have another second as it's being distributed.
And I would like a copy of the amendment as well. Thank you.
Okay, we got Senator Champion, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A5 amendment articulates driving privileges, and if you look at lines 1.5 to 1.13, it just talks about what a driver's license mean, and that this would be a Class D license, not a Class A, B, or C, because a Class A, B, or C is a commercial license, and there are other restrictions by federal law, but this would be a Class D license. Line 1.18 just adds in the language driving privileges license, as does line 1.26. If you look at line 2.16, it again adds in driver privilege license and a fee that would be attached to anyone who would apply for and in hopes of receiving this license. One other difference that I'd like for you to look at on page 4.1, I'm adding or would like to add in some language that I think would be very important on this driver's license should this committee allow for it to go forward. On the driver's license, I'm asking that there is a language added that says a driving privilege license must be plainly marked for driving only. So on the license, Class D, there must be this language that says for driving only. And with that, if you look at the last page of your document, I'm showing you two illustrations. And the person who's in the photo is not anyone I know, but we just got a person who we think would be great. And if you look at the top license under Minnesota, that language for driving only would be there. If you look at the second or the one below, it could have the information right by where it says issued, and then it says driving privileges only. I am suggesting that in the event this goes forward, that for driving only be at the top, so that it's very clear that this particular license is only for driving, and it would help to address some of the concerns that I heard in the other committee around not wanting anyone to be able to use this license for anything other than driving. So they couldn't use it for safety net services. They couldn't use it for voting, even though we know that you have to be a legal person 18 years of age in order to vote. But we just wanted to be very clear that it's for driving purposes only. And with that, I would be happy to stand for questions.
Okay, well, Senator Champion, first of all, we have the A5 amendment, so you're moving that amendment?
Moving the A5 amendment.
Mr. Nauman, you...
Mr. Chair and members, I think that Senator Champion had referenced that Ms. McCormick was here from the department and that she might be able to also speak to us about the fiscal implications of the amendment. It was my understanding that she was prepared to do that.
And here's Ms. McCormick.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services within the Department of Public Safety. And we have not received an official request for a fiscal note, at least not that I'm aware of at this time, but we have talked to our card vendor at the request of Senator Champion as to what it would cost to change to add a license that would have this particular header that you see on the image, the card images before you. And we have an estimate that it would cost $15,000 for that particular card design to be produced.
And Ms. McCormick, is that then covered by the fee? Fee that's charged?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we would need an appropriation from our special revenue driver services special revenue account because we wouldn't have the expenditure authority to be able to use it otherwise.
Oh, and that was my assumption, that it came from the revenue account, but you need the appropriation from the special revenue account for that purpose.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Sarah Fishbot.
And I'm just wondering, why are we repealing all of this on the last couple of pages? I mean, proof of residency, all of that. So I'm wondering if that's – someone could give me a reason why we're repealing all that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fishback, that is – I think the intent by Senator Champion was to delete the status check – language that occurs on our driver's license now for someone that's here temporarily on a visa. That status check date is the date when the card expires currently for people that are here on a visa. So that would be the language that would be repealed in the legislation from what I understand.
Ms. McCormick, this only applies to the visa. I mean, this that would only apply to the language that applies in the applies to visas.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fishback, that's my understanding from looking at the amendment that I looked at, and it would still require that. You would still have to have a primary document and in order to be able to get a driver's license.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we've had a discussion a couple of different times on fiscal notes in this committee, and this is not an omnibus bill. But I've got to say that I'm troubled by the fact that this is the Finance Committee and we don't have a fiscal note on this bill. And very honestly, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see a fiscal note on this bill before we send it to the floor. I'm not indicating whether I'm for or against the bill. I mean, I'd certainly be willing to review it. But sincerely, Mr. Chairman, I think we ought to have a fiscal note on this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Pappas.
I have a fiscal note.
We do have a fiscal note.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal note that it shows the $40,000 cost that was included in the packet is on the original bill. The subsequent amendment that has been put in front of the committee, as Ms. McCormick has testified, adds some additional cost, and the amendment also changes some fee revenue. So I think I think it's the fiscal note itself at this point doesn't represent the language if the language were if the amendment were added to the bill.
And Mr. Chair, and it's my understanding as well from reading the fiscal note and also talking to the fiscal staff that the cost for the license would be covered by way of fees. So that is my understanding.
Answer, Chairman, that's what Ms. McCormick just indicated, is that would be done through the special revenue fund, you know, with the department. Now, obviously, the issue raised comes with the A5 amendment. It doesn't come with the bill itself. With the bill, we do have a fiscal note, and I guess, although it's a minimal amount of money, we can certainly take action on the amendment. And I know Mr. Nauman wanted to talk to Ms. McCormick for a second. But I'm thinking that we could take action on the amendment, add it to the bill, possibly lay the bill over then for a formal fiscal note, which I assume we'd have in the next few days, and then really reschedule the bill or withdraw the amendment. But it seems to me that the issue is a relatively simple one. And obviously, it's not a large amount of money. I assume we're going to come back with a fiscal note that would be similar to what Ms. McCormick just testified to. It would be $15,000, $20,000. It would be from the special revenue fund. We could probably write that right now, but we don't have that exact figure in front of us.
Mr. Chair, it would be my pleasure, Mr. Chair, that we adopt the A5 amendment. We can, lay the bill over so that we can get an updated fiscal note, because I'd rather that everyone has comfort around the table, because I'm not trying to pull a fast one by any stretch of the imagination, and I would just like for us to clearly know what the cost will be. I think that would be the prudent thing to do. And I have one other comment once we move the A5 amendment, if the committee so.
Well, and additionally, you've got some folks who wanted to testify on the bill, I believe. So we want to make sure we get their testimony in. And because there are a lot of people here interested in this bill, should make sure everybody understands that the absence of a fiscal note tonight does not suggest the bill will be – I can't speak for what the committee is going to do or not do with the bill, but the absence of the fiscal note in and of itself does not suggest we're not going to be able to pass the bill in the next few days, but that as the Finance Committee, as opposed to a Policy Committee, we need to have a better sense of what the exact cost is. But we have, Senator Champion, we have your amendment. You've moved the amendment.
I'd like to move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. So, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, I like the amendment. It's good. I just had one question, and the department might need to answer this. Would it be possible to add where you're indicating for driving only, to add after that not valid for identification, since that's the purpose of the amendment? Now, the one potential problem I could see with that is if that's going to create programming problems if you have a real estate challenge on the card. And
Mr. Chair and Senator Nienau, one of the reasons why we focused in on these words is because we think that our clear message gets across and it saves us money, because the more words that you have on there, the more cost. One of the things that I did try to do is I did attempt to get a fiscal note on this A5 amendment as well, so that we would know. So I've been doing a lot of inquiry around it ever since Senator Miller and I talked about it and Senator Pratt and I talked about it. So we've been doing a lot of work around it. So with that being said, that's the only reason why we thought this would be appropriate and would still convey the message as to what this as to what Senate File 271 is about.
We have Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Chair, and maybe the testifiers will be coming forward that are going to talk about the potential savings. And Senator, you may have even talked about that with regards to insurance.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, because I always make a mistake on your name, so I'm always practicing that word. The savings, from my vantage point, happens many different ways. One is when individuals are traveling upon our roads, and we want them to be legal, and we want them to get insurance, because we want to make sure that if someone gets in an accident with another Minnesotan, that there's the appropriate insurance there, because we've been seeing lots of situations, unfortunately, where people don't always have insurance, and we want to make sure that there's that public safety issue and that savings from that vantage point. Secondly, if we believe that 80% of folks, 80% of people drive to work alone, that we want to make sure that people are getting to work and can have a job and really make sure that there's a savings there as well. So we don't expect them, nor can they right now, take advantage of any of our safety net programs. But we want to just make sure that all around people are not also being afraid of cops stopping them, and then, you know, there's more costs with courts and those other things. But streamlining this process so that people have the ability and the opportunity to get a license for driving only. And so I believe that there are inherent costs and savings in that alone.
So Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. This wouldn't have anything to do with ownership of vehicles then. Would they be able to own a vehicle with this driver's license? I mean, that's a question I have. If you have an uninsured motor, I'd sooner have them licensed than insured. And I think that's where you're going with this. I think that's a good idea.
Yes.
Would they have to drive their own registered car? I mean, they do drive cars. Obviously, you said 80% of the people that drive to work certainly drive their own cars. So did the insurance industry weigh in on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I've had some discussion with insurance companies, and their position is that they've been neutral on the bill, but they were clear to say that they believe it's always important for people to be insured and for people to be legal to drive.
Thank you.
Okay. We have Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Champion, and I apologize on the fiscal note. Senator Lurie found it for me, so I wish to apologize to you for that.
And right now, just so people know, we're on the A5 amendment.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. The A5 amendment, Senator Champion, talks about if a person is unable to demonstrate legal presence in this country, I assume you are talking about folks who are undocumented. Am I correct on that?
Senator, Chair and Senator, yes.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, if we then go to the, you know, your main bill on the primary document for purposes of getting a driver's license, they can use an unexpired passport from another country. How are these two ideas going to dovetail together? You know, I would assume that we have an undocumented individual really not going to be able to get their hands on a passport from another country. Perhaps I'm wrong. Can you kind of tie these two concepts together for me?
So I'm going to speak to it, and then I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick to speak to it as well, because the department has a history of doing this. Number one, you're absolutely right from the vantage point that a person would have to demonstrate that they have a primary document, and that could be a passport from another country, and that it has all the security features that one is supposed to have, as well as a birth certificate. So that is a process that we want to make sure that information is presented and is verifiable. And the department has done this, and they have the necessary training in order to continue to do it. And so I think Ms. McCormick can, you know, talk about that and how these two concepts are reconciled.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator Newman, we obviously, some of the documents that we're talking about, we don't necessarily look at all the time, but certainly we have people that come from other countries who have passports from those countries that they use when they come here, and it's usually would be tied to an immigration document because as of now we require legal presence in order to get a driver's license or an identification card. But we do have documents that we get from companies that show us what the features are for various documents from various countries around the world, and also and so those would be And we do fraudulent document recognition training with all of our staff and the DIA and our driver's license agents. So certainly we would have to expand upon that with this law, but it certainly would be something that we would be able to work on.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Champion, I mean, I'll ask the question in a different way because I'm trying to track with this. For purposes of your A5 amendment, what documents would you propose the state of Minnesota rely on in order to be in a position to issue a driver's license to an undocumented person?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Newman. If you look at page number 3 in the main bill, and if you look at starting at line 3.5, it articulates what we think a person or the department should accept in order to make sure that there is a primary showing. For the purpose of this section, government identification card means a valid, unexpired passport issued by a country other than the United States with a certified birth certificate from a country other than the United States. And then it also goes on at 3.8 to say a passport and a birth certificate under this paragraph must have security features that make the document, you know, clear and safe, and so that one is not able to just alter it easily. So some of the security features that we also have to have with our government-issued identification as well. So those are the things that would be acceptable under 271 as documents that the department would be able to accept in order to provide someone with a driver's license.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, if an individual entered this country illegally without the documents described beginning at line 3.5 in your bill, they would not be able to get a driver's license that you are describing in your A5 amendment.
Mr. Chair and Senator, actually, they would. In fact, I had a conversation with one of the folks that I know who is from another country, and they came legally. They have a passport. They have a birth certificate from their country, but there was an incident that occurred where their green card expired. But they still have this information that they would still be able to provide in order to be able to get a driver's license. So there's the possibility of doing that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, that's not the scenario that I'm trying to grasp here. I'm talking about an individual who enters this country illegally without the document described in your bill. The passport from another issued by another country, the birth certificate entered by another country. I'm talking about an individual who comes into this country, doesn't have these documents. Am I correct that under the terms or under that situation, they would not be able to get the driver's license described in A5?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Okay. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, and following along the same lines of Senator Newman, I think that some of us, as we've been following from afar the path of this proposed legislation, and I haven't heard it in committee before, but I've been following the changes, and I really liked the change you made to put the statement on the driver's license. But now it seems to me that now that I see the language starting on lines 3.5 and going on, it seems to me that we're leaving out a pretty large swath of who we're trying to actually put in a situation where they're driving insured under some means that, you know, we have some visibility around that. Because it seems to me of all those folks that might be on the road undocumented, there could be a pretty significant portion that might fall into this category. And so was there any thought to how you might also provide this additional provisional type of identification to that group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, There was some talk about that. There's been a lot of discussion around Senate File 271. And what appeared to be the choice was to find a way to make sure that there's some comfort language and assurances around government-issued form of identification where there's safety features so that we can at least deal with that portion of the demographic right now. In the event that we believe that there would be a need to revisit this, I believe that that's something that we will be able to do in real time. But as it sits right now, after talking with the advocates, talking with a number of different people, this is the language that we believe to be helpful and acceptable at this particular time and will take us a little further.
Senator Stumpf.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Early on in your testimony, Senator Champion, you mentioned something about these provisions were in law before 2003. Can you spell out why they were taken out of the law after 2003?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, it's my understanding, and Ms. McCormick can become, you know, much more ingrained in this, but there was a number of different changes that happened after 2003, especially in light of 9/11, and so there were some changes that were made, and so that's how we sort of landed upon where we are right now. But I will let Ms. McCormick correct me if I'm wrong, and if there's any additional information that she would like to share, I'd like for her to do that.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump and members of the committee, as you know, there was a lot of support for trying to ensure that people were who they say they were and we could document that they were here in the country legally after 9/11. But even before 9/11, there was a call for one driver, one license, one individual, and to ensure that person is who they say they are. So starting in the late 90s, I wasn't with Driver and Vehicle Services at the time, but that was when we started trying to increase the requirements to ensure identities, and there were various immigration documents that were just pieces of paper that in 99, or maybe it was 2000, right after I started with DVS, that we decided that it wasn't a secure document. And so we know we had rules that changed that from being allowed because it was something you could, you know, you would be able to duplicate easily. So the laws started getting strengthened in 2003, the major change was that we established primary and secondary documents, and also for people that were here under a temporary visa, there was a status check date that was put on the driver's license. So that was the change that was made at that particular time.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. McCormick, wasn't it in 2000 or after 9/11, several of the those that were involved in 9/11 had multiple driver's licenses from multiple states, and I think the thrust of Homeland Security was to try to get a much more smart verifiable kind of a driver's license, which I think the state of Minnesota did, and it wasn't very hard to duplicate driver's licenses before that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, yes, we did, and you're correct. I think there were several people that were involved in 9/11 that had gotten licenses, I think, in the state of Maryland, and I'm not sure if it was another state as well, but there were and that's why, in general, the DMVs across the country have very similar standards. Even if you're not, as our state does not comply with the Real ID Act, every state in the country is ensuring that we have security in our cards so that they're not easily duplicated and that we try to ensure the identity of that individual and tie it to a residence within the state.
And, Mr. Chair, just for clarity, that's why we have some of the language that's in our bill so that there's information that must be verifiable, that it still has strict security features, and that we still maintain this level of standard so that we are able to still provide what I would consider, you know, good public policy around how do we make sure that we can also keep our drivers safe and that people are still able to improve their quality of life.
Thank you.
Right, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Champion, I thought the Mexican consulate in St. Paul was issuing identification cards to some of the undocumented workers so that they could open bank accounts and, you know, have some kind of identification based on documents they had. Are you familiar? Did you consider that at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, I'm not as familiar with that process because this again is about driving, and so I didn't sort of reach into those other areas in order to go beyond the scope. But what I will say,
Mr. Chairman, I was looking at it as an alternative to a passport or a birth certificate.
I believe that Ms. McCormick can respond.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, the Mexican matricular card does have certain security features that are part of that card, and certainly that may be considered at some point, you know, whatever, if that would be considered, I think, according to what we're reading, would be one type of identification card that probably could be used in this case. Because it would be, and it is secure, and my understanding, it does tie you to your coming from Mexico. It's from the province in Mexico. That's what my understanding is. I don't, you know, I've seen demonstrations through our AMBA board on the card and the security features, but that would probably meet the requirements. We'd have to look into it if the bill passed to see if that would be the case.
Sir Lori.
I'm raising my hand, but I do have a question. Are we still on the A5 amendment? It seemed like most folks were getting comfortable with it or something.
I'm still on the A5 amendment. I was just about to ask the same thing myself. But we do have Senator Champion's motion on the A5 amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Lori, you were correct. We were comfortable.
And Mr. Chair, what I would like to say, just because one of the questions that a person or some members have asked is whether the states currently provide these sort of driver's license. And Washington State, for the last 10 years, has provided this sort of driver's license. New Mexico, for the last 10 years. Utah, for the last 10 years. And Illinois just recently adopted this sort of license since January of 2013. So there's a number of other states that have done it, and there's a number of different ways that we believe that we still can provide the standard that this great state is accustomed to, and we think that this bill does it.
All right. And, Senator Champion, you indicated that you have some folks you'd like to have testify. Is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Chair, and we did indicate to them that brevity is the order of the day. So Monica Vega and Lores de la Luz.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Engelbretson.
Just real quickly, I don't see any numbers on the fiscal note. Well, that was kind of a foolish statement, wasn't it? How many numbers are we talking about the impact in the state of Minnesota? Is that someplace, Senator?
Senator Engelbretson, that was the point of earlier. We're not sure. Okay. And so what we're going to do is listen to the witnesses, see if there's further committee discussion, and lay the bill over until we get the final fiscal note.
So we have one. So Mr. Chair, we'll start here and then go there. We'll start here, here, and there. There we go.
Sir Chairman, I'm not going to ask you to repeat that.
No, okay.
But whoever's going to go first, just welcome and please identify yourself.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Hickey, and I am the current president for La Puerta Abierta United Methodist Church Women's Group. La Puerta Abierta United Methodist Church is located in St. Paul, Minnesota. We are a multicultural church which welcomes everyone regardless of your race, economic status, or immigration status. The UMW women of La Puerta Abierta, along with the majority of United Methodist women across the state of Minnesota, strongly support this bill. This bill would allow undocumented immigrants that reside in Minnesota to legally obtain a driver's license. This would allow all individuals to safely drive on our roads. Currently, many individuals are driving their children to school, driving to work, and driving to their places of worship without a proper license. Many of the children that are being transported by undocumented drivers are natural-born citizens of this country. They are being forced to be put at risk because of our current driver's license requirements. This bill would affect a lot of families, not just in the Hispanic community, but in communities of different cultures all over Minnesota. This bill would be very important for me and my family. My husband was born in Mexico and came to Minnesota in 1996 without proper permission. We have been together for over 13 years, and we have three beautiful children, ages 10, 9, and our youngest is 8. My husband did have a valid Minnesota driver's license for 14 years. Approximately 3 years ago, he received a letter in the mail stating his license was canceled. But if he were to show proof of residency to this country, he would be able to get it back. My husband is not able to do that due to the current immigration laws. He does not have legal status at this time. We are continuing to pursue legal status for him. It is important to note that he has not committed any crimes other than crossing without permission. My husband was working at a company where he had to drive a company vehicle. He ended this job when he did not have a valid driver's license. We lost this income for our family because of the current modification not allowing him to drive without proof of citizenship or proof of legal residency. While I am able to legally drive, we still would like to be able to rely on him to transport our children to church and school and any other events. This bill would allow my husband to legally drive our children safely to soccer practice, church, school, and be able to legally drive to work. Driving is an essential element to our everyday family life. Our family has experienced both sides of this issue. My husband was able to have a license and drive legally and has also had to drive now without a license. The struggle is much greater without a license on many levels. We are very clear that a Minnesota driver's license for our family simply means he is able to legally drive a vehicle. Minnesota is not the only state that is looking into modifying the driver's license. As Senator Champion stated, other states have already modified the requirements, allowing undocumented immigrants to legally drive, making the roads safer for everyone. I believe this is a bipartisan issue. There are a wide variety of people and many different cultures that are affected by this bill. When deciding to vote yes or no on this bill, please consider the thousands of families, families like mine, and many other families in different areas and different cultures all over Minnesota that will be affected by this legislation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And whoever is next, if you might identify yourself.
Hello, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jovita Francisco. I'm from state of Mexico. I'm from indigenous community. I have lived in Minnesota for many years, and I consider this place my home. My aunt brought me here at the age of 15 years old with the consent of my parents. It has been 18 years since I have seen my parents. I remember when I arrived in Minnesota without a jacket. The weather was so cold. It is now too late to see my father because he has already passed away 3 months after my children got involved in the 35W bridge accident. I was working. I was waiting for my kids to arrive from field trip when I receive a call to mention the accident. I felt in the breach, the call says, when I hear this phone call. I felt so desperate asking myself how to get there with no license. My husband had to first drive to find them at the bridge. After the accident, we was forced to change my life, my weight of my life, when I had to begin driving with my children to clinic, therapy. Thanks God, nothing major occurred like the other unlucky family involved. A constant fear follows my family every time we cross the simple bridge. When the friends of my children talk about how their parents have been deported because no license, they look at me and give me a big, huge, telling me, a big hug, telling me, I hope God take care of you and my dad. And I hope the government does not separate us. It is difficult to explain how the government systems work whenever they ask why things work the way they do. It has been many times now that my husband and I have been taken to jail for not having a driver's license. My children suffered and asked themselves, what do we do now? My life has changed in a way and I didn't plan it to be. I now have two children that I have to ensure when it comes to their future. I want them to finish school and have a good career that no one in our family has ever gotten. Please help me to adopt a family to drive without fear, not to be scared when I drive to work and when I take the children to church, when I take the children to the programs. My son likes a lot soccer. He's the best, and all the time asking me to take them far away to play soccer. Please help me, my children, the assurance that when I leave with the car, I will return just as I left. I'm asking Democrats and Republicans to work together at this time to make a better Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Francisco. And welcome, if you could identify yourself, please.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Monica Vega. I've been living here for 12 years. I'm married, and I have four wonderful children who were born here in Minnesota. My husband has two jobs to support our family. I'm a full-time mom. That's really hard, let me tell you that. My husband has a driver's license, but I don't. My kids are the ones who are most affected by this issue because they want to participate in different after-school programs. But how am I going to do that if I don't have a driver's license? I know that they provide like a bus for them after school program, but where we live, they don't provide that. So as I mentioned before, I have a really, really busy husband. So he's not able to go to work and then go and pick the kids up at school. So like I said before, how can I explain to my kids that I can take you where you want to go because I don't have a driver's license? My 10-year-old son doesn't understand that. In one occasion, I explained to him, I need many documents to have a driver's license, but unfortunately, I don't have them. One of them is a social security number. Then, you know what he answered? He said, Mom, why don't you use mine? Use it, and you will be able to drive, and you will be able to take me everywhere I want to go, Mom. I told him, that's not right. That number it's only yours, and you are the only one who can use it. I'm not able to do that, honey. He say, okay, Mom, don't worry. When I get older, I'm going to have a driver's license, and I'm going to take you wherever you want to go. That's my goal. When I turn 16, that's the first thing that I'm going to do, Mom, and I'm going to do that only for you and also for my little brothers because we really want to do things, but you can do it. If I have a driver's license, I will be able to take my kids to after-school programs, to wrestling. That's the sport that he loves to do. To dance. My daughter, she loves dance. And of course, I will take them to the museums. They love to go to the children's museums, to the science museum, to the art museum. Those are the places they love to go. But we are not able to go because, as I mentioned before, my husband is really busy working, and I can't do that. Also, I will be able to get more involved in the schools. I am a volunteer in my children's schools. I love to do a lot of art with them, and in that way, I'm teaching them, our culture too, because if you know from where you come, you know where you want to go. That's something that I tell my kids all the time. Please, please, help us get more involved in the community. Help us get out of the shadow, and please, help me to drive my kids to school and all the different programs that the community offers for all of us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Vega. Questions for the witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, obviously, to everybody else who's spent the evening with us. We have the bill in front of us. Again, we're going to lay the bill over until we get the fiscal note and then schedule it very quickly thereafter. So we'll have a chance for further discussion, but with Senator Champion here, I have Senator Champion, a member of the committee. He'll always be here.
That's right, Mr. Chair. I want you to know I'm your worthy vice chair. I will be here.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, how does the bill line up with Homeland Security? Because Ms. McCormick mentioned that regarding the 9/11 situation, and I'm just wondering if you've had a chance to talk with federal authorities or people here in Minnesota that are aligned with the federal or with the Homeland Security and what their thoughts are on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, it's my understanding that it lines up with state and federal law. That's one of the reasons why we had to change the classification of the license to a Class D, and she can come up and give some additional feedback on it as well.
Ms. McCormick.
Senator Anderson, obviously, Department of Homeland Security enforces the Real ID Act, and so Minnesota is not in compliance with the Real ID Act. We're not allowed to because there's a law that was passed saying we can't comply with the Real ID Act. But what Minnesota does do is ensure that we have primary and secondary documents so that we can prove people are who they say they are, that we have ways to verify legal presence, and that we have secure features on our card that make it difficult to be able to replicate our driver's license and ID card. In general, I think that there are several states that are looking at having what they call a two-tiered driver's licensing system, and some of that is because they have cards that don't apply to the Real ID Act and some that do because some states, if you are required to comply with Real ID, you're supposed to have that on your driver's license. They haven't, at this point in time, Department of Homeland Security hasn't started enforcing the Real ID Act, but if they would start doing that, you know, that would be of a concern to us to ensure that we could have people that would be able to, they'd be able to get on a plane and be able to come back to our state. So we basically substantially meet all the requirements of the Real ID Act. Our card does, and our processes do, And we are also, we also have the impasse that you have enacted into law, the enhanced driver's license system, and that also meets Department of Homeland Security requirements. And so in general, we would have the same process, except these would be different, a different set of requirements. So that's why they're calling the states. I think there's seven states that are looking at legislation this session. There are six states that have it in place, a two-tiered card. So it would be a card that would be for people that have legal presence, and then there'd be another card for undocumented immigrants. And so that's kind of just the state of things right now in the country. So,
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick. So if the federal government were to start enforcing the Real ID Act, any idea of what the cost might be to us? I mean, that, we've met, from what you're telling me, we've met most of the requirements of that. But if they were to enforce it, is there anything else that would be something that we're not aware of? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, no, not at this time. The department has basically been silent on it. I think a lot of it has to do with various pieces of legislation that the Congress is considering at this time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lindbergh.
If I can just give a little more information on Real ID. I carried the bill on prohibiting Real ID in Minnesota. And we were the 15th state to join the effort to say no to Real ID. There's now over 30 states that have said no to Real ID. But the threat by the federal government was that if we did not comply with a driver's license that had a Minnesota skin, if you will, on the front of the card that looked like a Minnesota driver's license, we would suffer all sorts of federal results. They said that we would be denied federal programming. Social Security would be halted. You wouldn't be able to fly on an airplane without it. But now that 32 states have joined that effort, the federal government has backed away from enforcement. And that's where we're at. And by the way, 200 of all 201 legislators at that time voted to prohibit Minnesota from being involved in it.
Senator Double, did
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was going to make that final point that Senator Lindbergh made. 200 of 201 legislators voted. There are other implications to Real ID, and that's, you know, kind of a federalized database with all of our driver's license data in it. We figured out having a common database just in Minnesota may be not the best idea. So, in terms of our security, just to, in terms of, well, I won't get into it. We're going to have that on the floor pretty soon.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Dibble was a co-author on that bill.
I was.
Yeah. Is there further discussion this evening on the bill or further questions for Senator Champion? If not, we'll lay Senate File 271 on the table. And I was just talking to Mr. Nauman to try to make sure we get the request in right away for the fiscal note. He tells me he's doing it right now. And Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, are we back here tomorrow morning at 8:30?
Yes, we are. And I was going to mention that. Obviously not with this bill because we won't have the fiscal note by then, but we will reschedule, Senator Champion, your bill. Once we get the fiscal note, we'll do it very quickly thereafter. So if there's nothing further, we'll adjourn for the evening and see everybody at 8:30.
Thank you, committee, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, boy.